Hello and welcome to the third edition of EIM Pod, the pensions podcast that takes the core issues in pensions of the week and explains them. I'm Sarah Bamwell, today's host, and I'm joined by Maggie Williams, publisher of Engaged Investor and Pensions Insight, on the eve of her departure. And she's going to talk us through some of the things she's learned and also some of the predictions that she made 10 years ago for where the pensions industry might be and what's happened since then. Welcome, Maggie.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Welcome.
So I found this amazing article from July 2010, where you've looked at what shape pension provision could take over the next 5, 10, or even 20 years. And obviously now in 2015, we're at the 5-year mark. So I thought it might be fun to have a look at what you said and why you said it, and whether or not you were right, and then more importantly, to look at what you think might come next, given everything that's happened in the last 5 years. So first, do you want to give me a bit of context for this feature?
Sure, yeah. Well, the issue that we'd had, titled The Great Escape on the front cover, followed on from the emergency budget, which took place just after the coalition government had come into being in sort of June that year. I think one of the interesting things for us was in that emergency budget was the announcement that the tax allowance for pensions would come down from the sort of whopping £255,000 that it had been in the past to what we knew at the time was that it would be between 30 and 45k, and obviously that's settled on around about 40k now. So that was a fairly big turning point for pensions. So we thought it was a really good time to sort of sit down and make some predictions around what we thought might happen in the future with pensions. But it was really intriguing going back over this and looking at sort of some of the things that we got close to. Some of them we were slightly off, and as interesting as anything, the ones that actually we didn't really mention at all.
Yeah, so I mean, let's start with something that I think you got very, very right. So very early on in the article, in almost your intro, you say DB pension promises from the past are catching up with large private sector companies, and talk about FTSE 100 companies having huge scheme deficits that exceed their stock market value. That's certainly an issue that's not gone away, is it?
No, well, I guess some of the recent stories that we've seen, particularly surrounding BHS and the like, indicate that very clearly. I mean, I think even back in 2010, we were already beginning to see those problems start to occur. I mean, at that stage, perhaps it was more around the fact that we were seeing businesses who were being hampered in what they would like to do next, whether that was merger and acquisition activity or anything like that, because of the pensions debt that they were shouldering. And as we've seen, as I say, very, very prescient in recent weeks, that certainly hasn't gone away at all.
Would you ever have guessed that pensions would be such front-page news day in, day out back then? I mean,
well, you know, it's funny, when we launched Pensions Insight in 2009, and back in those days when print was everything, we used to run it as a monthly title. And one of the concerns that we had when we set it up was we'd gone down the route of having a topical front cover every month, and we were thinking, well, what if there isn't anything topical to say in any particular month? And I have to say that I don't think there was ever a month when we didn't have at least two choices of what we might put on the cover. So it's been an interesting period to be in pensions, for sure. I don't think that's going to slow down anytime soon.
Yeah, no, there's definitely been a lot of change recently. And I think, you know, throughout these predictions we made, that change was kind of pretty high up the agenda. Sticking with DB a little bit, one of the other things that you predicted would happen was sort of the shrinking of DB schemes and the shift to more independent trustee-led governance models. I mean, that's something we've seen. We've had the rise of sole trusteeship, for instance, which is kind of almost a step further than that. Are we going to see ever more reliance on professional trustees, or will we still be able to keep that balance?
I mean, I think it's going to depend on individual schemes getting to a certain point, and particularly where they are in their, you know, in their runoff. I think one thing that's an interesting balance is that obviously you can understand fully the need for and place of independent stroke professional trustees, but there's also something very important still around member nominated trustees and the element of member representation and member voice that they give. So there is a fine balance on what you lose as well as what you gain within that, I think. Increasingly, though, inevitable, if you've got a legacy DB scheme, which is a profit and loss consideration for a company rather than an active, supportive pension scheme, I think the logic involved in a sole trusteeship there, you can see the point from the company's point of view.
Yeah, and I think you're right to question that. And I think people are still asking the question, what do we do with these schemes as they get smaller and smaller and have fewer members? Another thing that you were quite worried about was public sector pension schemes, which, you know, makes sense, and I think you were right to be worried about. A lot of what you were talking about was sort of a mixed benefit approach and then also higher contributions from public sector workers and things like that. Has the public sector pensions area moved in the way that you were thinking it would?
Well, I think we already knew that the hints of the Hutton report were out there, so we knew that public sector pensions, both sort of funded and unfunded, were going to come under very close scrutiny. And I think particularly with the change in government that we saw come in 2010. And of course, we've seen a lot of those come through now with the sort of NHS and the teachers' pension changes this year, yeah. And changes to the sort of employer contributions in some of the unfunded schemes like the police scheme. And of course, the enormous changes that have happened to LGPS over the last years. So yeah, we could already probably see that one on the horizon, but it wasn't really a surprise to see so much change happening in public sector pensions.
Yeah, one thing you didn't predict was the pooling that's happening at the moment and the forced pooling. If somebody had suggested that was going to happen back then, would you have been surprised?
I think, I mean, when you look back on it, it is a logical step if you're looking at particularly sort of cost control within there to look at pooling. So naturally, I'm going to say that yes, of course we would have thought about it. And I'm sure we just ran out of space.
Well, yeah, so you've only got so many words you can fill in, I suppose. What else have you talked about? There's an awful lot, obviously, back then DC was in its infancy, particularly in terms of auto enrolment. So, you know, this was kind of when employers were first being signed up. And I think you've done quite a good job of predicting some of the issues that would become important. So you talked a lot about trying to get better member understanding and better explanations and communication and engagement. You talked about, you talked a little bit about perhaps, I think you mentioned baby boomers taking the opportunity to use drawdown, and I don't think you went quite as far as the pensions freedoms, but then nobody expected the pensions freedoms, but it was sort of hints of that move away there from annuities. You know, are annuities over? Is it the end of them, or are they going to make a comeback?
I mean, I think, I make no apology for not predicting the freedom and choice changes. I don't think we were the only ones that didn't see that one coming. But yes, I mean, the need to think through a sort of potentially longer period in retirement that isn't a sort of one-size-fits-all that, you know, come some of the sort of certainly kind of level annuities of the past, for example, might have given. So I think one of the points we did make in here somewhere was given a greater understanding of what people's income needs are in retirement over the course of a longer period of time would help the industry to develop products that are more suited to that and combine that idea that, you know, if somebody's been paying into the default fund at the default contribution level for their entire working life, they're not suddenly going to be in a position to pull amazing stunts financially once they suddenly retire. And there isn't also a point in someone's retirement when they're actually not really in a position to make such kind of effective choices anymore. So I do genuinely think that there will be a place for something like an annuity in the future that helps to stabilise and give some predictability to people's income in retirement. But obviously, with the sort of current landscape, it may be a while before we see those. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of work going on in many product houses at the moment to see what comes next and effectively gives some of the benefits of annuities without the drawbacks.
Obviously, this article looks at, you know, you predicted as far as 20 years into the future, and we've still got 16 years to go. So on some of them, we won't know whether or not you're right for some time yet. But
I'll come back.
You'll come back and we'll do the rest of it. Brilliant. One thing you did predict was that in 2020, we might see mis-selling scandals where pensioners complain that they weren't told about how badly income drawdown might affect their schemes or about DB to DC transfers and whether or not that's a good idea. Is that something you still think is on the cards? Because obviously DB to DC transfers have increased and people have more options now and more people doing drawdown.
Sure, and obviously it's a fact that everyone that's looking at a sort of DB to DC transfer has to get advice in the first instance. I mean, I think to broaden that out beyond sort of mis-selling scandals necessarily to pension scams more generally, and obviously, again, that's very topical at the moment, I do believe is really a very big risk area at the moment, and it's good to see the pensions regulator and the industry doing so much work around that, because introducing freedom and choice doesn't always necessarily mean that someone will make the right choice. So giving people as much support as possible and as much accessible, affordable advice as possible, you hope would help to minimise those mis-selling and broader scam problems.
Yeah, it's interesting. You don't really mention scams in the piece. Was pension scamming an issue back then, or is it something that's come in more since, as we've moved into DC and people have more freedom about what they can do in their DB pots? Is it kind of more of a new issue?
I think it's become an increasingly important issue, for sure. And I think for all the time that you've got people relatively safely and comfortably tucked away into a DB scheme, which is being run by a trustee board, obviously all the kind of fit and proper and rules around prudence that brings into place, then you would hope in that older context that members' rights and members' choices would be better protected. I think now that we're in a much more flexible environment, and as I say, that does have its advantages, it makes the opportunity for individuals to make decisions that aren't right for them much more possible.
Yeah. Because, of course, we know that when people only have a choice of annuities, they weren't picking the best annuities for themselves. So it kind of goes without saying that giving them more choices is only going to make it more complicated for people. Another thing you talked about a little bit in this is sort of corporate wraps. Now, corporate wraps have kind of gone away a little bit, but we are seeing the rise of, you know, lifetime ISAs and things like that, and much more flexibility and range in the benefit structure. Is that something that you thought was going to happen?
I think the introduction of corporate wraps version one, if you like, was interesting because I think a lot of people started to bring them to the market just as companies were beginning to consider auto-enrolment. And I think one of the flavours, sort of trying to think back to what we did at the time that I picked up from this, where we talked a lot about sort of mixed benefits as well, was the thought that perhaps companies would say, okay, this is auto-enrolment, it's a chance to look at our broader benefit structure and consider how our workforce are planning for their future financially overall. But of course, that didn't really work out because most people went, we've got to think about this auto-enrolment thing and we haven't really got the capacity or possibly even the finances to consider any other approach at the moment. But now, and more driven by the freedom and choice changes than by the auto-enrolment changes, I think that they're beginning to be interesting again. And this time round, if you do start to introduce things like leases and other savings vehicles alongside pensions, then yes, you can begin to see that there is a good case for them there.
Yeah, and credit where credit's due. You mentioned ISAs quite a few times in this, which is oddly prescient because it's always like you knew that the lifetime ISA was coming. One of the interesting things, I think, is when you looked at 2030, so you know, 15 years from now, You said that you thought perhaps excessive withdrawals from corporate ISAs might have been capped or addressed. Obviously, now that we're seeing a shift to ISA-style pensions products, that might be something that we see happen as they worry about people taking too much money out. Do you think that's on the cards?
I think if we get to a stage with tax regimes where, for in whatever form, let's call it the pensions ISA because it's the shorthand that we've all used on it, if pensions ISAs become more prevalent, I think perhaps you will see some kind of limitation around withdrawals from them because really if you're asking somebody to use a particular type of vehicle for their retirement savings and then they can take all the money out of it whenever they like, the overall long-term element gets lost. So I think a lot depends on the relationship more generally between ISAs and pensions as saving vehicles for retirement.
Definitely. I don't know if you saw this morning, but Ros Altman, our recently former pensions minister, has been slamming the lifetime ISA today and saying that she thinks it's really dangerous for pensions because of being sold as a retirement vehicle, but there is no cap on when and how you can take your money. So clearly there's some tension there that we might see come out more if we potentially shift more towards an ISA style arrangement.
Sure, and I think there is still a lot to resolve around the kind of anomalies in the tax element. I mean, the only sort of background, I suppose, that I would put on that is if you get a product that just generally encourages people, and particularly younger people in this instance, to save for the long term, for their retirement, then that is a positive thing. But I think the fact that Lisa sits outside the occupational space, basically it sits outside Autumn and all the rest, it still means that there's a lot of really good reasons for paying into a traditional pension, if you like, and I, you know, I think that's still got to be the backbone for long-term saving.
Absolutely. And then, last one, looking at this article, at the end of it you come back to the revival of DB as longevity estimates stop rising and companies can get a better grip on how long people might work for, and there's better certainty. And you also touch on how people working longer has led for fewer opportunities for young people in the workplace, so they're saving later, and concerns about how we can get them to retire and people working longer. I think this is something that, well, this is certainly something that concerns me, and I think it's something that we perhaps don't, as an industry, talk about enough. Like, what are we going to do about the people who have to work? So two questions, really. One, what are we going to do about this intergenerational unfairness and people working longer? And two, are we going to see DB being reborn?
I think the first of those, the intergenerational issues, it is something that is going to have to be thought about more in time, I feel. I mean, if you look at the sort of role of a pension beyond it being a long-term savings vehicle, it's also a workplace management tool in that, with or without a default retirement age, it gives people an opportunity of a certain amount of certainty at which they have a point at which they say, okay, I know now that I'm all right for the future and I can retire. Rather than that decision always being made on, do I know if I've got enough for the future? Can I be confident that if I retire now, I'm going to be able to support myself throughout the rest of my life? And I think that's obviously the certainty that DB would have given in the past, or at least given people an opportunity to understand where they were financially. Whereas obviously DC, in whatever form you choose to take it, does have a certain amount of uncertainty involved.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a whole raft of economic things that we could discuss underneath this in terms of job creation and generation, and whether having sort of old people work longer just simply means that you've actually got a more buoyant economy and you're generating more jobs within it, and there's plenty of those jobs for 16 to 31 year olds as well. But of course things may also flip the other way, that if you have a job market and which is kind of pared down in any way, then you know the opportunities for everyone become less. I mean, I think we were being quite ambitious with a suggestion that DB might be reborn, and I certainly don't think that in any form of the past, with the many, many layers of promises and regulation that sat around it, DB would ever live again in that context. But I do think in terms of it being a supportive tool for the employer in being confident that people can retire from the workforce, and that does generate other opportunities for people, younger people within the company, that the pension still has a role to play in that context.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And do you think maybe like a shift back to sort of DB before DB got over-regulated and promises were enshrined, where there was just more sort of risk-sharing and more certainty for members? Do you think that's...
I mean, I think certainly going back to the risk-sharing model, risk element, I mean, obviously we've collective DC has come and gone as a debate point.
Yeah.
It may come back again at some point, who knows? We didn't put a prediction either way on that one. But I think plainly employers can't be expected to shoulder all of the risk, as ultimately has been pretty much the case with DB. But I think that there may need to be a model in place at some point where there is some employer responsibility and some employee responsibility, so perhaps a little bit more of a balance.
Perfect. And then, you know, so you made all these predictions back then, some of them very accurate, some of them not so accurate, but and some things you missed, like pensions, freedoms, but completely understandable, because, again, no one saw that coming. Not even Steve Webb. I'm going to put you on the spot now. What are your predictions for the next 10 to 15 years? What are the three big things that are going to happen in pensions?
Wow, that is putting me on the spot. It's interesting. I kind of did have a look through and I thought, well, what things did we not talk about? What things did we not predict in there? And actually, it was surprising to see there's absolutely nothing at all about master trusts in here and the rise of master trusts as a vehicle for DC. And obviously, we've seen new announcements today around sort of some elements of master trust governance, which I think is an absolutely critical element that needs to come in. It is one of those things where you can stand here and look back and think, how did that happen? That basically any man and a dog could set up a master trust and use it for auto-enrolment. So I think that that is a very important part of the future. And I say we didn't put that in there, but obviously I think that cements the future of master trusts as being an important part of the landscape.
Yeah.
I find the advice element very interesting. Obviously we're seeing a lot of interest in and development of robo-advice, digital advice at the moment. I think what we will see in time is more of a balance between when it's right and appropriate to use those sort of digital tools and when face-to-face information becomes most appropriate. I think, again, with robo-advice, I don't think we've even started to see some of the capabilities that could technically come out of automated advice systems, but any digital system or any automated system is only ever going to be as good as the puppet master behind it, if you like, whoever's actually determining what information you're going to be shown and how you're going to be shown it. So I think that's another area where I think we will need to see more development and ultimately more regulation around it as well. What else did I think? We didn't predict charges caps.
No.
We didn't. Although I think again they have driven some quite significant shifts in how default funds are structured, and will continue to be structured in the future. And it's interesting to see what's going on in the market in terms of how you build diversity and risk management within default funds. While still keeping within that charges cap. But I think the big one will be around the tax regime, certainly within the next 5 years, I think. Obviously, one of the interesting sort of debates you can have is whether pension still sits in the DWP or whether pension should be sitting in the Treasury, and I know that's a debate that if you get any more than two pensioners people sitting around a table with a bottle of wine, they will discuss that one at length. but I do think we could see some very interesting shifts, and I think ultimately the tax regime determines an awful lot of how people view pensions and how they will develop in the future.
Do you think we could see the pensions ISA rearing its ugly head again? Are we going to have to call ourselves PISA Insight from now onwards? I might need to rethink that name.
I don't know. There are strong lobbyists on either side, and I think a lot of decisions are based on who makes the strongest arguments at the time, who's listening, and how agile those people are in thinking about not just what that means for today, but also what the unintended consequences are and the longer-term considerations. So if that's not a fence-sitting answer, I don't know what is.
That's how we like to end these things, on a fence-sitting answer. Now, if I told you 5 years ago that we'd be sitting in a room recording a podcast about your pensions predictions, would you have believed me?
No.
So when we have you back in 5 or 10 years' time to analyse these predictions and talk through them again, goodness only knows what technology we'll be using. You'll probably be being interviewed by a robot. But thank you very much. I think this has been really interesting. That's probably all we've got time for. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been the INA Pod.
Thank you very much.